beyond that.
Well, what were you doing before you got here?
Well, I had been very briefly in Old Military Records Division at National Archives.
Yeah, wow.
And I say that with great joy, that it was a very brief stay. It wasn't very interesting, frankly. But luckily, I was asked to come up here. I don't know. I think I was getting desperate. I don't know what I would have done if I had not. But what we're trying to do is, in the interviews, is to get a background outlining staff responsibilities and how various staffs function during the administration. We're not going deeply in policy areas or really asking what you think might be sensitive areas, other than to mention areas of responsibility which you have, or projects which you may have worked on, particularly noting ones which you feel would not be well documented in paper files, and which would be significant historically and which should be talked about in more depth in a later oral history project. At this point, the tapes are being kept with virtually no access to them. They will not be released to anyone until sometime after the president leaves office, and at that time we go through the normal screening process that any presidential papers would. They are considered president's property. We, for a while, after we began this project, we did not have a clerical staff to do full transcriptions of the tape, which would normally be done in an oral history project. So we kind of compromised and started writing brief narrative summaries of the tapes, which caused us all kinds of problems, because it almost became more of a problem to condense it than just to go through the straight transcript. So that didn't solve our clerical problems or limited staff time either. What we're doing now is just keeping the tapes. If you'd like a copy of the tape, I can give that to you. And then when we do get the clerical staff, which will hopefully be before the president leaves office, we'll send you a copy of the web transcript for you to edit and then send back. So you will have a chance to edit it if you
missed. Fair enough.
We're asking very basic questions. You came to the staff in 71, is that right?
June of 1971, June 7th.
Where were you before you came here?
I was a graduate student at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And at the same time, I was with the law firm of Murphy, Lamry & Murphy. I was practicing law in Michigan on the graduate school. That was kind of a few years ago. I was involved in Boston.
Mm-hmm. How were you recruited to the staff?
Well, I was interested in coming to work in Washington for a couple of years before I made my ultimate decision as to which way I was going to go in life. And the White House had sent recruiters up to Harvard to look around for people, talent scouts out of the Fred Malik's shop. So it was kind of a marriage between my interest in coming down here and their interest in getting people into the administration, young people. So I came down after meeting with them in Cambridge, came down here for a round of interviews. Talked to people all through the domestic council and John Dean's staff and elsewhere. Finally, it came down working for John Dean and Chuck Colson. And I worked for Chuck Colson.
What is your time as staff assistant?
Yeah.
And is it staff assistant to Chuck Colson? Or?
Well, that seems to be something that's very unclear around the White House. Publicly, I'm a staff assistant to the president. Technically, I'm just a staff assistant to nobody. Just, they just use that title. But I'm not really sure whether a lot of people have the same confusion of whether I'm a staff assistant or a staff assistant to the president. They're both the same. I don't think there's any difference.
But you reported directly to Chuck Colson.
That's right.
Could you describe what your duties have been on the staff?
Well, my duties were twofold. I in the first instance, handle most of Chuck's writing responsibilities. I drafted everything from administration position papers on various major issues to some speeches for cabinet members and White House staffers. I did all the fact sheets that were distributed to the administration, all of our administration spokesmen. I have done considerable, in connection with my writing responsibilities, I've done considerable briefings. Example, somebody's going on, cabinet member X is going on Meet the Press, and I would be one of the people that would brief them on not so much the substance as the politics of the issue. In other words, if one of the foreign policy people were going on TV to discuss a foreign policy issue, I wasn't the guy to give them the foreign policy, substantive foreign policy briefing. I'd be the guy to give them the political foreign policy briefing. In other words, what are the party lines, so to speak? What kind of a posture are we taking on a particular issue, public posture? And in that regard, I ended up briefing at one time or another most of the cabinet members and a lot of senior level White House people and so on and so forth. During the presidential campaign, I did that with the surrogates, presidential surrogates. I prepared all of their briefing materials on issues both foreign and domestic, put them together in easy to read form. In other words, I would sit down with a Kissinger or an Ehrlichman or somebody and get all the substantive information that they wanted to transmit to our people. And then I would translate it into something that people could read and understand, and just a shorthand version of the technicalities of whatever the issue was. So when I say writing responsibilities for Chuck, I'm talking about very, very broad types of activities. Mm-hmm. Everything from, as I said, writing speeches to drafting position papers, papers to be distributed to the media on issues, clarifying the president's position. Papers for internal distribution of White House staff, papers that were distributed to the whole administration. So that's part A of my responsibility. Part B is that I'm a lawyer and I've spent a lot of the last 2 years rendering, drafting, researching, and rendering legal opinions on issues that weren't strictly legal, i.e. those issues that were legal but had very significant political overtones, political implications. Most of the strictly legal stuff was handled, obviously, by John Bean's staff. The types of legal things that I got involved with were those which not only involved legal issues, but involved other issues, mostly political, but sensitive issues that involve a great deal of sensitivity. For example, I spent a great deal of time working on the ITT case. The president wanted somebody to monitor day to day what was going on, in addition to those people who were doing it to justify it. To examine the transcripts, to determine if, in fact, any improprieties took place, any illegalities, to research the law, to recommend strategies, things that the administration could do in presenting its case that would be helpful. And that was the kind of an issue that was I think was obvious, has far more significance than strictly as legal merits and legal issues of that. So that was the kind of stuff I did. I did a lot of legal work during the campaign on making determinations whether things that we were about to do or were complied with the law. Staffs other than our own were involved in that too, but the president likes to cross-check. He likes, rather than place all the responsibility for example, determining whether We were complying with the registration laws in a certain state campaign, rather than relying totally on the people of the committee where you're like the president being involved in these areas. So you would also ask people on staff just to kind of double check. So I did whatever legal responsibilities Chuck Colson had for the president, I was glad to do it.
Did you report directly through Chuck Colson or?
Well, yes, I did. 99.9% of my activities on the staff were reported directly to Chuck. 0.1% of my activities I dealt directly with Mr. Paulman. On no occasion, except possibly one, did I deal directly with the president in this regard when he was getting the work assignment from him or reporting back. So essentially, I spent all of my time reporting, receiving my orders from and reporting to Chuck.
What areas were you reporting directly to Mr. Paulman or the president?
Well, in both instances, whenever I reported to them, it usually involved the solicitation by Mr. Ehrlichman or the president of opinions, suggestions, recommendations. For example, I received a memo from Mr. Haldeman right after the election last November, requesting that I submit directly to him a paper, a position paper, on what I would like to see as the leading priorities of this administration during the next 4 years. He asked the question not only in that, the way I've just recited it, but also what would you like to see this administration remembered for? It's another way of kind of asking the same question. What should we do in the next 4 years that we haven't been doing? You know, what should we be spending more time on and what should we be spending less time on? So I did that, and I wasn't the only one who was asked that question, but I sat down, it took quite some time and quite a bit of thought. And so in that instance, he had asked me for an opinion, a position paper. If I were the president, what would I do? So that, my dealings with the president were kind of the same thing. And I fell into the category, although I just turned 30, I was 29 for most of the time when I was on the staff. So 28, 29. So I was part of the under 30 generation on the White House staff. So we were in a kind of a little bit different category, those of us in that category, with respect to the types of things they asked us. And, the president liked to get input from the younger people on the staff. So now I'm no longer a younger person on the staff. He doesn't talk to me anymore. No, just kidding.
Did Doug Hallett work under you or very closely with you?
Doug, it was funny. My relationship with Doug is always a very good one, but our professional relationship with the staff was never really clear. And I think that I'm not really sure why it was done this way. I have some opinions, but Doug, according to my instructions, was working directly for me. He did take a lot of his work assignments from me, but he also took a lot of work assignments from Chuck and from Mr. Haldeman and from the president. So whereas I would argue that I was instructed that Doug was working directly for me, Doug would argue that au contraire, he wasn't working directly for me, he was the independent operator on the staff, and that he was to assist me when I needed assistance. But it worked out because of our close personal relationship. We never had a problem. Any time I asked him to cooperate, he did, and did a very fine job. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy.
I talked with him right before he left the staff.
Yeah.
And he said that most of his files would be in yours.
Yeah.
And,
right.
He stated that, to his knowledge, no one was replacing him in kind, that you would cover most of what he had been doing in one sense or at least.
Right.
I think he described himself as somewhat a thermometer of opinion for a specific group which he might represent in the sense of being.
Well, Doug
was a fantastic idea man. Mm-hmm. Aside from being an outstanding writer, and that's where he really helped me out in doing a lot of the writing, we had a tremendous load of writing responsibilities that we had to undertake during the campaign and before the campaign. But he was a tremendous idea man. I mean, the guy could sit down and recite ideas like, you know, on any given subject. You asked him, what should we do here? Doug would just, most of them very good, some a little bit far out, but most of them very good ideas. So he was invaluable in that respect, not only for me, but for the president. And that's how we got the staff in the first place, is because of his notoriety as an imaginative young man and a good writer and very successful at his age in campus affairs and political affairs. So. But no, to answer your question, nobody did replace Doug. Just once he left, many of his responsibilities were picked up by people down the hall in the Dave Gergen speechwriting operation, and the rest of them were extinguished.
Would you describe your own role here as somewhat an idea man in a little bit different area than Doug's?
I suppose I was less of an idea man than an executor of requirements by Colson and Haldeman. I'd say, if you could break it down in percentages, maybe about 15% of my time was spent thinking about things and presenting ideas and methods of solving problems that we were confronted with. I had a great deal of discretion in certain areas. I could, when they asked, for example, the president's mining of Haiphong Harbor back in May 8th of 1972, I was asked to head up a task force of White House people whose goal was to communicate what the president was doing to our own people and to the public. So I had people, I was coordinating the task force. I had people, I was working under Mr. Haldeman's authority, but I had people in the Ray Price speechwriting operation, which is now the Dave Gergen speechwriting operation. I had a lot of Herb Klein's people, the radio and television people. I had a lot of our own people, Chuck Colson's people, Pat O'Donnell, for example, and scheduling of speakers, and Henry Cashin and dealing with professional organizations. And I had some other people, miscellaneous places like Pat Buchanan, some of his staff. So, and my responsibility was to communicate, to make clear to everybody in-house, and I'm talking about that in the broad sense of the term, White House people, administration appointees, presidential surrogates, this happened to be during the campaign, or just the beginning of the campaign. And so I had very broad discretion in how I was going to accomplish that objective, and not only notifying our people in-house, but also the public. And of course, there were, you know, Ziegler's operation, the president was on television, so the people saw it, and Ziegler had briefed the press. Kissinger and Ziegler briefed the press, so they knew about it, but that usually isn't enough. So I had broad authority and discretion doing whatever I thought was necessary to get the story out, programming speakers around the country in key media centers, preparing documents and talking papers and briefing papers for both internal and external distribution, getting organizations briefed, all the military-related veterans organizations, all the professional associations, making briefing speakers available for them to be briefed. All of this was done on a crash basis because of the necessity of getting everybody to know what was going on right away. Setting up a thing in the State Department, where State Department Auditorium, where we had all the administration appointees, about 2,000 people, in for a briefing on what was going on by all the high-level people, Kissinger, General Haig, and so forth.
But then covered the whole spectrum, getting people to write op-ed pieces in newspapers, bringing in key media editors to be briefed. So, in instances like that, I had very broad discretion to use my imagination, and that was it. If you could think clearly and think of a lot of good things, you could implement them. They were reasonable, and most, you know, you had the authority to do it, so. But I would say only about 10 or 15% of my time was done in actually using my own head to think these things up.
In implementing something like the ideas from this task force, did you work through, say, Mr. Donald's speakers, in scheduling speakers, or work through Herb Klein's office or Kathleen Boston's operation for mailings?
Yeah. Well, all of those people were under me, technically. And so what I would do is I would meet with, Colson would meet with Haldeman, I'd meet with Colson and would go from there. And so what I would do is I would decide when I, you know, we needed something to be mailed and we needed the speakers to get into a certain area, we needed an analysis of where we could go, put speakers in or where we should put them in. When we wanted to get people on the Today Show and on the Sunday talk shows, Meet the Press, Issues and Answers, then I was the guy that called and said, such and such is available, let's try to get them on. Or if we needed speakers to go into a certain area, then I'd call O'Donnell, find a forum. If most of the time they have an overabundance of requests for speakers, so that was never a problem. Find a forum and get us a speaker and get them in there. Or I would say such and such, whatever the issue was, to get Ambassador Bush in and see if he can make it. So I would deal directly with the people that had those substantive responsibilities.
Well, you mentioned one domestic issue, the ITT thing, and then the Hyphon Harbor bombing. Did you concentrate more in domestic areas or in foreign affairs, or
well,
did it balance out?
I would say that 50% of my time, in terms of, you're talking about my communications responsibilities, which I think is a good way to characterize it. 50% of my time was spent in foreign policy. And the reason was that we were, this last 2 years has been the height of Vietnam, wrapping up the war, so to speak, and winding it down. It was also the period in which the SALT negotiations took place and were successfully concluded last year. It was also the period when the president was going to China, made his China announcement. It was also the period when the president went to the Soviet Union and negotiated, spent a lot of time explaining to everybody what the nine treaties we signed with the Soviet Union, I think there were nine, and not only SALT, but the Space Technology Treaty, the Health, the Environmental Treaties. So, plus we had all the end of the war amendments. I was right in the thick of that aspect of our foreign policy, and working with congressmen and getting them materials and explaining our positions to senators and representatives, and our arguments as to why it would be inappropriate at a given time for such and such a resolution or amendment to be passed. So about half my time was spent on foreign policy, maybe even more than that, maybe 60% of my time. Because it was really a foreign policy period. Of the other 50 or 40%, depending on whether I spent 50 or 60% on foreign policy, I spent about half that time, if not more, on the economy. This was also the period where we were having problems with inflation, when the president imposed the wage price freeze, which I was in the thick of from beginning to end, when we were in a period of high unemployment, and in a period where unemployment was hitting Vietnam veterans and young people very hard, a period of strange economic happenings, in a period where we had tremendous inflation, But unemployment, high unemployment at the same time, which is highly unusual, defied, in many cases, defied a economics textbook explanation. Fortunately, I studied some national income accounting at Harvard just before I got down here, so I wasn't flying blind, so to speak. So I spent about 40% of my time on the domestic side, but most of that on the economy. Although I did get involved in the other issues like busing, major issues during the period. But most of the domestic side was spent on the economy.
To go back just a minute, you described your role as communications, which made me remember Desmond Barker was in that area,
right.
Mr. Colson's staff. Did you work with him?
Right. Well, Des had a specific role on the staff in communications. Mm-hmm. His job was to, as I understand it, his job as I understand it, was to deal with the department and agency public information officers, to coordinate the flow of information, to make sure that what was coming out of the White House was getting down to the departmental and agency level, that press conferences weren't held in conflict. In other words, we didn't want to announce a major new health program on the same day that the president was going to announce the withdrawal of another 150,000 troops or the terms of the treaty. So there was, as I understand Des's role, he was in charge of, among other things, coordinating the departments and agencies and making sure that their public information programs were vigorous and effective, and that they things that they were saying were consistent with what the White House was saying. You know, obviously, we didn't want the people speaking with different voices on matters of presidential policy. So, going back to this task force, when we needed something from the departments or agencies, or we wanted their information officers or their communications people to do something, or to schedule a press conference, or to provide their own people with information, or to release something publicly, then I would go to Des Barker, and then Des would go down the line to them. So we worked, together. That wasn't his only role, but I guess that was his principal one, obviously.
Are there specific areas, such as this task force, that you haven't mentioned, which would be subject areas?
That you mean with respect, no, subject areas. Well, by necessity, and this is an area of great debate, it's a big gray area, but the obvious question I'm sure that's raised by everything that I've said is, well, how much of your time are you spending on authorized official U.S. government presidential business, and how much of the time are you spending working to get the president reelected in a political context? Well, in the area in which I worked, and in the area which is the area in which Mr. Colson worked, that is a very big gray area. And so we had obviously have responsibility to limit it to the extent possible our activities to official presidential business. It became a very gray area to determine whether when our opponent, Senator McGovern, during the campaign charged that having a F-15, developing the F-15 fighter plane, or the B-1 bomber, was totally unnecessary, or that we had too many men stationed in South Korea, or too many bases in Germany. We obviously have an obligation to respond to that, not so much as a presidential candidate, but in the context of the U.S. senator is making very serious charges against the president that he's wasting defense dollars and we've got people unnecessarily stationed overseas or we're developing a totally useless weapon system. So in that context, we had to respond, but then you could make a good argument that, well, by responding or engaging in political polemics and, you know, we're using taxpayers' money to, well, I happen to, if we were to make a decision, I would decide in favor of responding because
despite the fact that you're in the middle of a presidential campaign, you still have to, when somebody makes charges like that, you still have to respond. So a lot of my time is spent in coordinating, more so than my originating response, coordinating the response to charges like that. Senator McGovern, for example, to be more specific, said that if he were elected president over the next 4 years, he would cut the defense budget by $30 billion. Well, nobody that I know of, no reasonable man, could agree with that assessment, that we could possibly cut $30 billion in the defense budget, even if we had great stability in the world and so on and so forth. Just the necessity of paying the salaries of the troops and of replacing worn-out equipment and so on and so forth would have gotten us damn close to the bare-bone defense structure. So what we had to do is we had to, we were put in a position of having to say that you couldn't possibly justify cutting $30 billion in the defense budget. And we did that. We prepared analyses, and of course the original work was done in defense and elsewhere, to show that you can't do all of the things that Senator McGovern was proposing at the same time and have a viable defense force. You can't cut the strategic bomber force by 60%, the tactical air squadrons by 40%. You can't eliminate the B-1 bomber and the F-14 fighter and the F-15 fighter. And you can't cut the defense establishment all over the place, cut the Marine Corps in half, reduce the size of the armed forces by another 1.5 million men after the president already reduced it by 1 million men, and have a viable defense establishment. So you could argue that, and some people have actually made the argument, that this isn't legitimate expenditure of time on the public payroll to be doing these things. Well, I, you know, would argue with the contrary. I think most people would agree that when charges like this are made, or suggestions or recommendations, then you have to respond to them. So a lot of my time was spent doing that kind of thing.
Inseparable.
That's right.
The issues are obviously going to be considered presidential as well as campaign.
That's right.
What, other than very briefly mentioned Doug Hallett's relationship, staff relationship with you, who else worked with you on the staff? Or first of all, who worked under you?
Well, Doug, except for those instances under extraordinary circumstances where I was put in charge of various teams and individuals on various projects as kind of a project manager, I didn't have anybody else under me. Doug was the only guy that worked under me, except for a secretary. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of an independent operator in that regard. Now, I worked with all the people. Most of my contacts, my day-to-day contacts, were with people on our own staff, with Bill Radigan, press, with Pat O'Donnell and scheduling, Catherine Balls and mailing, and so on and so forth. The constituent group with Bud Evans working with aging, and Mike Balzano working with ethnics and blue-collar people, Don Rogers working with labor. So most of my day-to-day contact were with people in our own immediate staff. However, I spent a great deal of time working with the congressional relations people, because a lot of the flow of the information that I produced and the requests that I responded to came from Hill. Our own supporters, sometimes people who opposed our positions, wanted to know where did we stand on something. So in many instances, I'd be working with the congressional relations people on the Hill.
Did you work often with John Dean's staff on areas which would have political ramifications?
The legal areas? Yeah, I worked with John's staff fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. With John himself, with Fred Fielding, with Dave Wilson, Pete Kinsey, and Chuck and John worked closely, periodically, on various matters, and so as a result, I was Chuck's staff guy in this area, so I worked mostly with their staff guys, but fairly frequently with Chuck.
What about outside the White House staff? Were there any departments where you had no contact?
Well, I spent a great deal of time, because of the amount of time I was spending in the foreign policy area, I spent a great deal of time working with the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. With occasionally with Dr. Kissinger directly, more often with General Haig, and most frequently with his staff members in each area that we were involved with. I had limited dealings with the State Department, but I rarely needed to deal with them because I had the people, the key people, foreign policy areas, we had them all here, so we didn't have to go through the State Department. But most of my informational needs were satisfied in the White House. If I were dealing, because most of the things that I dealt with things that were breaking, fast-breaking events, or things that were just happening, announcements that were about to be made. So the at the stage that I got involved with the substantive area, the decision-making process had arrived in the White House. So I could talk to, for example, we were going to deal with busing. We made some major announcements on busing during the last 2 years. I didn't have to go to the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. It would have been foolish of me to do so because the people who were making the ultimate decisions on busing, the president and his immediate staff, were right here. They knew more, in most cases, than the people, anybody I could have found at HEW, with the exception of maybe his secretary, assistant secretary. They were closer to the problem here, closer to the final decision that was about to be made. So in most instances, I deal right with the people here. It was a rarity that I would go out to a department to get something sensitive. If it were just basic raw material on an area, then I could go to the department or the agency and get it and call them up and say, look, we're about to do this, I need some background information, or we send it over and they do that. But that was the exception rather than the rule.
You describe yourself as a coordinator of administration response. Obviously, that's going to necessitate some input into policy. Just by how you present a briefing paper or...
That's true.
Whatever. Is there any way you could weigh that input?
Well, when I say that I was a coordinator, a project manager for some of these responsive actions that we took in the informational area, I was doing it as an agent of Chuck Colson. That was one of his responsibilities. Chuck was the guy that was involved at the substantive level. I wasn't. Occasionally I was, but that was a rarity. In other words, when, for example, when a decision was going to be made on reorganization of the drug fighting program, Chuck would be there as a presidential advisor when they were sitting down to go over the pros and cons of the various options that the president had. Chuck would be there as an advisor. And to the extent that he contributed to the substantive decisions, the decision-making process, by his recommendations, most of which were made from a communications or political communication standpoint, to that extent that he had a role in the substantive decision-making process, I didn't get involved that way. I did indirectly in my dealings with Chuck and my recommendations to him and suggestions on how to do things. But I wasn't sitting in on the high councils that made the substantive decisions in foreign policy or domestic policy. Chuck did.
In writing a position paper or fact sheet or whatever, was everything that you did reviewed then by Mr. Colson at some point?
No. It was reviewed by, most of the things Chuck took a look at, but it got to the point
where two things happened. One was that he developed a trust in my abilities and my work and in my techniques. And B, we got so damn busy and we had to do everything so fast that if I had to wait sitting outside Chuck's office every time I had something to be done, that it, you know, would delay it sometimes to the point where we'd kill it. For example, if we were invited to put an op-ed piece in the New York Times, the New York Times had a deadline of let's say 4 o'clock in the afternoon for the next day's edition, and I stood outside Chuck's office waiting for the clear, it would never get in. So it was a combination of the trust aspect, and on the one hand, and the time element on the other hand. That after this developed over a period, obviously, but after a while, in let's say 75% of the cases, I wouldn't have to go back through Chuck with something. But in every case, I would go back to the substantive guy that gave us the information. In other words, if I sat down with General Haig for an hour to talk about why it was necessary for us to bomb above the 30th parallel or something, resume bombing, and we'd sit down and talk for half an hour, an hour, I would then go back and reduce this into something that I felt was readable and understandable by somebody and what I thought the theme should be. I would always go back to the individual or to check it for factual accuracy and for substantive correctness. But that was it. I wouldn't then go to Chuck, and in most cases I wouldn't go to Chuck and say, look, would you look at this before we distribute it or before we hand it over to such and such. But it got to where I knew what Chuck was looking for. I knew his style. I knew the types of things, the way he liked things presented. So, and to my recollection, once I did something and it was put into the system, and Chuck then later said, oh my God, what did you do? You know, we never had that problem.
Would the position paper or fact sheet or whatever then go out with your name on it?
No.
Or would it have any staff name on it?
Depending on what the nature of the thing was. Nothing went out with my name on it. Depending on how it was distributed. Sometimes it was distributed internally by Herb Klein, the White House staff, and Herb Klein had his distribution list. Sometimes it was distributed by Chuck. Sometimes it was ghost-written for somebody else. I did a lot of ghostwriting for various people on various issues in various newspapers, so I shouldn't mention their names, but I've written pieces for cabinet members and so forth that we get placed in the newspaper. Well, you'll never know that I had anything to do with it.
Will that show in your files?
Yeah, it would.
On the same line, you mentioned doing some speech writing. Will it show in your files who you were doing the speech writing?
No, not necessarily. No, in fact, in most cases it wasn't. I very rarely wrote full-length speeches. I rarely would write full-length speeches. When I talk about speech writing, what I would do is if there was an issue that arose, if there were an issue that arose where the president wanted his spokesman, his officials, his appointees to talk about it, no matter what the issue was, then what I would do is I, either for a specific individual or for people generally, I would write what we would call speech inserts. A page, 2 pages, 5 pages, 10 pages, whatever the issue was. So that if the secretary of Department X, which may have been a domestic department, let's say commerce or agriculture, giving a speech, and the president wanted his officials to speak out on a foreign policy matter,
all this cabinet member would have to do is either insert it into a speech someplace, it'd be probably placed directly, or work it in there himself. But he had the data, he had what we wanted said, and he'd be able to just incorporate it. This was a ready-made piece of paper. And in many cases, we would do it at the very last minute, where a cabinet would send some messenger to the airport to catch cabinet member X, who had already written his speech and was ready to give it, to say, look, stick this in. So in most cases, we did it. It was generally applicable. It wasn't done for a specific individual. In other cases, if we knew a specific individual was going to a particular forum, we could just tail something directly from him and give it to him and ask him to do it for him.
Were there specific individuals whom you wrote for frequently?
Yeah.
Could you name
them? Some people? Oh, sure. All the cabinet members, for example. We've done stuff for Secretary Rogers, Secretary Layard, for Secretary Volpe. You know, and we've done it for members of Congress. I don't think I should mention any names there, but where they've asked us, you know, I'd like to say something about busing, and I agree with the opposition, but I'd like to be more precise to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. Can you give us something? I'm going to speak at the Future Farmers of America convention.
Was that usually done at the request, when you're not, aside from writing a speech insert for general use by administration spokesman, when you were writing for a specific individual, was it usually done at their request, or was this?
Most of the time it was not. Most of the time it was on our motion.
Mm-hmm. And you would work through, when, say, working for in Congress, you'd work through then for congressional liaison.
Right.
So,
right. Say so we'd like somebody on the Hill to mm-hmm. take a position on this. Sometimes I work directly with people on the Hill. I would always go through congressional relations so that they knew I was going, or they could make suggestions that they could help. I never wanted to be put in a position where some congressman or senator calls congressional liaison and said, I have this guy up here who says he's from the White House. Do you know him? Oh, yeah, I know him. Well, what's he doing up there? Well, I don't know. You know, it's a sensitive area. And that's as it should be. Congressional relations people should know about every single contact the White House has with the Hill, and they do in most cases. For example, the president, who asked, getting back to the question, did they ask us or did we ask them for these materials? Well, after a cabinet meeting where the president would be exhorting his cabinet to speak out on some issue, speak out on the need for everybody to cooperate in phase one of the wage price period. Well, obviously the Secretary of Agriculture or the Secretary of Defense of State, who isn't involved on a daily basis with the economy and, you know, has other things to do besides reading newspapers to find out what's going on, and in many cases that doesn't necessarily tell them the truth, shouldn't say the truth, but doesn't give them an accurate picture of our own position. They'll in turn say to the president, well, we'll be glad to speak out on it, but, you know, we'd feel safer if we got something from the White House to tell us, give us an idea of what you would like to be discussed and how you want it said and what you see as the major issues. So the president will turn to Chuck Colson and say, Chuck, take care of it. So that's an example where they ask us for materials. In most of the cases, though, we would ask our people to speak out, our White House staffers, senior White House officials, cabinet, Republicans on the Hill, so we would provide them with information and ask them if you would, you know, please use this in a speech or say this or, you know, to discuss this issue or to defend us on such and such.
What, if you could, areas which would not be well documented in the paper files do you think you would be most able to contribute to in a more in-depth oral history project, either subject areas, specific policy areas, or other either very specific or broader.
Well, I think probably the area that I could probably, if we had more time or whenever that time is available, contribute is the relationship between the interface between the White House as an operating governmental institution and the White House as a political operation in its role in re-electing the president.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is an area which isn't documented and wouldn't be documented, and I think it's a very interesting area, and I think that it's one which, to my knowledge, hasn't been explored by White House scholars in the past. At least I've never read anything in depth about the actual mechanics. How does the White House function during a campaign, is what I'm really saying, on the working level. And that you won't find in anybody's files.
Did you coordinate also with the Republican National Committee?
Yeah, worked with the Republican National Committee very extensively, and I worked with the Committee to Re-elect the President very extensively.
Who did you have most contact with in those?
Each of those places?
Yeah,
the Republican National Committee, I had very extensive contacts with Mike Baroudi, for example, with Senator Dole, number one, directly, as the chairman. With Mike Baroudi, the press officer, actually Tom Wick, and, Will, and Mike Baroudi. With Bob Chase, the head of the research operation up there, which just provided us with invaluable assistance, more along political lines, research lines, and substantive lines.
That was the operation that Don King started.
Yeah.
America.
Right. At the Committee to Re-elect the President, I worked with everybody from the heads of constituent groups, like Larry Goldberg with the Jewish groups. Before I forget it, now that I'm thinking of constituent groups, getting back to the RNC, I spent a lot of time with Laszlo Pastor, who was the head of the ethnic operation there. I worked with, getting back now to the committee, I worked with Duvan Chumwe, the press head of the press operation, very extensively. Now that I'm trying to think of who I've been working with so often, I forgot. I worked with the people that dealt with campaign speakers. They had their own scheduling operation over there. I worked very extensively with the legal people, Glenn Saddam at the committee, and Stan Ebner at the Finance Committee, who we elect the president.
I think I kind of sidetracked you when you were talking about the role of the White House staff during an election.
Yeah.
Did you want to say anything more about that?
No, I just think that that's an area that is worth exploring. It's one that I was directly involved in. It's one that you won't find in the papers. And I think it's interesting to note that Ralph Nader has sued my boss, Colson, Herb Klein, and Bob Finch. Well, actually, he sued the Secretary of the Treasury to compel Colson, Klein, and Finch to give back that portion of their salaries, their governmental salaries, during the last 2 years, or how long they've been on the staff. Valuing the time that they spent on political activities as opposed to governmental activities. And this is what one of the issues that's going to arise is, where is the interface? What, you know, what is political, what is not political? What's legitimate? What's a legitimate professional activity in the White House for staffers to be engaged in? And what is illegitimate from a political standpoint? And these issues are going to be raised in that suit. And I think that they're interesting, and that's an area that I think we could explore if anybody were interested.
We did talk very briefly with Mr. Carlson before he left, and I'm sure he would obviously contribute to that area. Are there other people who might not be as obvious who would be able to also make
a contribution? Well, I think Herb Klein and Ken Clausen in the communications operation, Pat Buchanan, very definitely. Bill Sapphire, who is now with the New York Times, very definitely. People in Haldeman's operation, Dwight Chapin, formerly with Haldeman, very definitely. Haldeman himself. Congressional relations people, Bill Timmons, Clark McGregor. I should also add one thing here, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but one of my other roles during the campaign was as a speaker. Most of the younger White House staff members, in fact, most of the White House staff members did some public speaking during the campaign. They also do public speaking anyway. You know, the White House maintains as kind of a speaker's bureau where the people are asking for White House representatives at various functions. Spokesman and lecturer. So during the campaign, I covered about 30 states speaking, and mostly to youth groups, but to a lot of ethnic groups, since I'm an ethnic, and a lot of Republican groups, a lot of college groups.
Did you, I know last year's class of summer interns did some of this too. Did you work with them at all?
No, except for Doug Hallett. Doug was a summer intern when he first started working here in summer of 71, and then stayed on as a regular staff member for a year.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, as planning staff in the Nixon Library, we're interested in files. Where are your office files now?
All of my files have been sent by my secretary, Becky Beck, to wherever it is that they're supposed to send them. I think Trudy Brown's office, so she's got them and cataloged them in and listed them and so forth.
And other than this area that you brought up for discussion on the role of the White House staff during the campaign, do you think that your files would fairly well document your activities?
Yeah. There's all of the position papers, all of the speech inserts, all of the fact sheets, many of the legal briefs, so forth, are all there.
Mm-hmm. And they will show your actual input.
Yeah.
In other words, they'll have some notation as to where you did receive your background information on a briefing.
Or who cleared them.
Has Becky Beck, has she been your secretary all the way through?
Just
usually
about.
The secretary will be the best person to talk to about where files.
Yeah, she was there except for the first, I'd say 4 months. I had another gal who was here temporarily, and then I got Becky, so mm-hmm. Becky would know.
If someone were to go back to the files, once they evolve and assemble in one place, the next number. What other areas, or if outside the White House, even, where would your files exist outside of that? In other
files.
Words, any
files that I don't have, haven't sent downstairs. I don't have any. I'm the type of person that never collects anything. I mean, that's just a personal foible of mine. I just throw things out as soon as I am through them, whether it be old newspapers or magazines. I collect no old funny books. I'm a neat person.
I don't know why, I don't know whether that's considered neatness, but I do it for that reason. I just don't keep things, I, so as, and sometimes it comes back to haunt me because I throw things out that a month or two later I really need.
I hope you threw them out to a pile. Right?
Well, I'm talking about things generally, so what I've done is I just, I don't, I know people when we do things, we have a lot of extra copies, well I'll keep one or two extra copies and just throw everything out. Some people have files bulging with 200 copies of something. I never do that. So, in answer to your question there, I don't have any White House files other than what's I've sent downstairs. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a personal library or anything where I keep all this stuff.
Do you have a resume or something we could just put in the file? Has anyone been assigned your specific responsibilities to replace you?
Well, most of my responsibilities have now gone down to the Dave Gergen operation. The pace of the work around here now, I mean, in this area, has just slowed down considerably because of the campaign being over and because of the reorganization that's going on and the reorganization of the White House staff, in effect. Mm-hmm. So,
Where are you going?
I am going to be the administrative assistant to freshman Congressman Paul Krumlin in Massachusetts.
And
so I have an interest in Massachusetts politics.
Is that where you're from?
Yep. Should be age 30.
Do you have a permanent address where someone might reach you within the next 10 years or at least a contact where you could be reached?
Yeah, I'll give you two addresses, the one that I'm at right now. 1200 North Nash Street. Well, it's on the resume. Apartment 828. Is it?
No, just it's Arlington.
Okay, 828 Arlington, Virginia. 22209. And my mother's address, which is probably the most permanent of all, is 46 Pentucket Avenue, Pentucket Avenue, Lowell, Massachusetts.
What's her name?
Mrs. Stephen. Carolyn is K-A-R-A.
Just as kind of footnote, are there any published articles that you know of which have accurately described functions of the entire Colson operation, or more specifically of your role?
Evans and Novak have done a couple. I don't remember the dates, and I don't have them in my files, but they've done. Within the last year, I think sometime during the campaign, a column in the Washington Post, more than one column. Most of the Evans and Novak material written about our staff is accurate. And I use a good accurate reflection of it.
And I'm going to ask you to sign this.
No.
This is the part of the...
Is this an indictment?
No.